Welcome to the Sharon Hour with me, Sharon James, on Laguna's KX935. My show tonight is about ants. Yes, ants, because I think they're kind of extraordinary. I mean, don't get me wrong, I'm the first one to lay down boric acid and get rid of them if I see a trail of them around my bathroom sink or any of those places they suddenly decide to inhabit and seem to arrive at from nowhere. The line just sort of starts and stops. You can't always find either a point of entry or a point of egress. But I'm full of admiration for them. They seem to have found the perfect way of cohabitating, the perfect kind of society, although I might exclude from the ideal the kamikaze ant, the zombie ant, and the crazy ant species, about whom you're going to hear a lot more later. But by and large, they're really industrious. It should be busy as an ant instead of busy as a bee, except I guess for the alliteration. I suppose it was originally buzzy as a bee. I mean, bees do linger. They stop and smell the roses. Have you ever seen an ant lingering? They're always antsy. If an ant is still, it's more than likely to be dead. That's because they serve each other, they take over from each other if the other can't manage a certain job. A fellow ant who has been given another job will switch and immediately fill in. There's a breed of ants that collect nectar, only they don't store it in bottles at home, they store it inside themselves. These special workers gorge on so much flower nectar that their abdomens get huge and enlarged, but at some point they know they can always vomit up the liquid for the colony to feast on. That's just the kind of thing ants do. They're courageous and strong. There's a particular kind of ant called the Allegheny Mound ant that will carry 5,000 times its weight on its back. That would be like you and me, presuming we weigh in the region of around 150 pounds, carrying a Boeing 747 on our back. It's insane, right? I mean, would we even do that for the person that we love most? And these ants just do it by rote for the sake of the community. So I think they're worthy of a show. They're going to get one anyway on tonight's KX935's The Sharon Hour.
Taking care of business.
Ants seem to take care of business very well. Ants is the topic of my Sharon Hour tonight. That's with me, Sharon James, with the help of entomologists and myrmecologists, brought to you here on Laguna's one and only KX935. We'll start with professional ant studier, Laurent Keller. This from his TED Talk.
If you think of ants on Earth since about 100 million years, and 100 million years ago, you had a few mammals, but very few mammals, and you had no humans for sure. So ants are social since 100 million years. Now, if you think of humans, sociality is very recent. First of all, humans are on Earth since only about 2 million years. It means in terms of lifespan, humans were quite rare on Earth until quite recently. Humans were one of the many species. They were almost absent. It's not like now. Now we are 7 billion. And if you think of the biomass of humans, there's another organism which has the same biomass. Which one? Ants. Ants and humans have exactly the same biomass. Last year, humans just reached the level of ants in terms of biomass on the Earth. So why did it take so much time for humans to reach this biomass? It's because we had to live together to create large groups, and this needed agriculture. Agriculture is very recent. It's about 10,000 years old. Cattle breeding is very recent. Villages, cities, it's a very recent innovation. And really what has allowed population to increase once we live together, it's an invention of division of labor, which has increased productivity, and also antibiotics. Not only antibiotics, but hygienic behavior, even more than antibiotics. It's really how we manage water in cities, which has greatly decreased mortality. Otherwise, we couldn't live in large cities. Everybody would die. To live in the city, we needed to have more food at one place. 100,000 years ago, humans had to move to find their food. They couldn't live in a single place. Staying in a single place, cities and so, has been possible because of the invention of agriculture. Agriculture has been one way to produce a lot of food at a single space, which have allowed humans to create larger societies, to make cities. So agriculture has been a very important feature for humans. And also breeding of cattle has been important to bring meat, so we didn't have to go chasing animals in the wild. They would be near the house and we could kill them when they are. So both inventions have been important to create large, dense societies in which we live together. The next important stage for humans has been division of labor. And division of labor has allowed to greatly increase productivity of humans. And it's only because of division of labor that we have very productive societies.
So what other species does all of those things that myrmecologist Laurent Keller mentioned? Myrmecology, by the way, is a branch of entomology that's specific to the study of ants. Those fascinating beings that, as we've just heard, are as competent as us, if not more so, at building cities and communities. Ants are the topic of my Sharon Hour tonight. That's with me, Sharon James, along with assorted experts culled on the topic on Laguna's FM listener-supported, member-supported radio station, KX935. Ants have been on this earth a lot longer than us humans, and one of the reasons is their biomass. Biomass, the weight of a species. In the case of ants, their sheer collective numbers has a lot to do with evolutionary survival.
Usually insects don't live very long. They will live a few weeks, most 1 or 2 months. But there are three groups of social insects which have a very long lifespan, and these are the termites, and ants, and the bees. And some species, the queen can live up to 30 years, which is really amazing. It's more than 100-fold longer than the solitary insects. So the evolution of sociality has allowed to have a major increase in lifespan. It would be like if you would find a primate which lives 4,000 years, 100 times longer than other primates. And what's very interesting is that queens and workers which have the same genome have very different lifespan. So workers live 10 or 20 times less than the queens which have the same genome. Ants did not only invent agriculture, they are also very good to breed cattle. And this occurs everywhere. Any ant has their own cattle. They will be aphids. They move them from one tree or from one plant to another one. And just as we do with our own cattle, when there are too many of them, sometimes they eat them. Another similarity between social insects and ants is self-medication. So when you live in group, we're going to contaminate a few more people. So ants are special organs to raise bacteria, and they have a lot of different antibiotics that they use in the colony.
They're pretty impressive, aren't they, ants? Not that there aren't downsides to them, which you're going to hear about later in this KX935's The Sharon Hour tonight. But before we get into their downsides, particularly in regard to us humans when it comes to this rather mental breed called crazy ants, let's hear some more of their virtues.
I'd like to share with you my love and fascination for these incredible citizens. Ants build giant underground cities with elaborate ventilation system and traffic routes. And if we scale these cities to our size, they're comparable to Zurich.
Ecologist Dr. Daniel Mersch, as you can probably hear, is from Switzerland.
Ants have agriculture. Ants use antibiotics and have medication to prevent the spread of disease. Ants succeed in all their feats without any need for hierarchy and prayer planning.
One could say they're libertarians.
How can a society function if there's no individual that coordinates the work, no one that oversees what has been done and what needs doing? In ant colonies, no one, not even the queen, instructs other ants what to do. Instead, all ants work together, and as by miracle, every individual seems to know what she should do for the colony to succeed. How is that possible? I wanted to find out.
So Danielle Mersch, ecologist and entomologist, part of whose TED Talk you're hearing tonight on this KX935's The Sharon Hour, set out to do exactly that. She travelled through the world of ants with her questions. But even if you could talk to ants, they couldn't hear you because they don't have ears. Their world is about pheromones and smells. That's how they communicate. So Danielle Mersch and her colleagues had to come up with their own unique form of communication.
What we did, we glued little pieces of paper with black and white patterns to the back of the ants. It's very, very simple. You print the tags on thick paper and cut them out. I did it by hand. I only had to cut 1,000 for my first experiment and 3,000 to 4,000 for the most recent one. Next, you put the ants into the cold room. 7 degrees is ideal for my ants. When the ants move very slowly, you take an ant and carefully fix each leg in plasticine. When the ant is stretched out, you put a tiny, tiny bit of skin glue on the piece of paper and then stick it to the back of the ant. That's it. You're done. You repeat the same procedure for the next ant, and the next ant, and the next ant, and the next ant. With 3 minutes per ant, 20 ants an hour, 140 ants in 7 hours, plus some time to warm up, I reach 1,000 in about a week. Once all ants are marked, life becomes a pleasure. All that remains to be done is put the ants in a set of 2 boxes in which the ants will live for the next weeks. It took 4.5 years of designing, building, debugging, time spent being frustrated and starting over again to perfect these boxes. Another challenge we faced was the infrared light that the camera required to film. It needed to be very, very homogeneous, because otherwise you would only detect the ants in the center, but not those in the outer edges. The solution seemed simple. We only needed to add lots and lots of evenly spaced light sources, but that generated huge amounts of heat in our boxes that we were already desperately trying to cool. And as if that was not sufficient, once we had solved the climate and light problems, the 800 or so marked ants decided to move each night into the tunnel that connected the 2 boxes. In the tunnel, we could not film them, making the whole setup useless, and the last 4 years a waste of time. But I could not give up. Luckily, after 6 more months, we had also solved that problem. And now, it only takes a day or two to have the setup ready to track ants. You put your marked ants under the camera, and the computer does everything for you. It controls the famous climate, turns the lights on and off, tells the camera to take images, scans these images to find the tags, and writes everything to videos, logs files, text files, and it sends you alert messages whenever it thinks something goes wrong. The result of the tracking, you can see where every ant went, which other ant was near, whether the 2 ants interacted together, who left first. The number of questions you can ask is overwhelming.
And Stanford ecologist Deborah Gordon had her own set of questions and conclusions. She likens the world of ants, the topic of my KX935's The Share An Hour Tonight, to our own brains in terms of how they spread information through neurons, as well as the internet, or as she dubs it, the antinet.
We're trying to understand why some colonies forage less than others by thinking about ants as neurons, using models from neuroscience. So just as a neuron adds up its stimulation from other neurons to decide whether to fire, an ant adds up its stimulation from other ants to decide whether to forage. Colonies are different in how they manage between spending water to search for seeds and getting water back in the form of seeds. And what we're looking for is how many interactions each ant needs before it's willing to go out and forage. And this raises an analogous question about brains. We talk about the brain, but of course, every brain is slightly different. And maybe there are some individuals or some conditions in which the electrical properties of neurons are such that they require more stimulus to fire, and that would lead to differences in brain function. And it turns out that the colonies that conserve water, that stay in when it's really hot outside, and thus sacrifice getting as much food as possible, are the ones more likely to have offspring colonies. Now, the internet uses an algorithm to regulate the flow of data that's very similar to the one that the harvester ants are using to regulate the flow of foragers. So data doesn't leave the source computer unless it gets a signal that there's enough bandwidth for it to travel on. In the early days of the internet, when operating costs were really high, and it was really important not to lose any data, the system was set up for interactions to activate the flow of data. It's interesting that the ants are using an algorithm that's so similar to one that we recently invented, but this is only one of a handful of ant algorithms that we know about. And ants have had 130 million years to evolve a lot of good ones, and I think it's very likely that some of the other 12,000 species are going to have interesting algorithms for data networks that we haven't even thought of yet. Collective search is of great interest right now in robotics because we've understood that rather than sending a single sophisticated, expensive robot out to explore another planet or to search a burning building, it may be more effective to get a group of cheaper robots exchanging only minimal information the way that ants do it. Collective search is the trade-off between searching very thoroughly and covering a lot of ground. When there are many ants in a small space, then each one can search very thoroughly because there'll be another ant nearby searching over there. But when there are a few ants in a large space, then they need to stretch out their paths to cover more ground. I think that they use interactions to assess density, so when they're really crowded, they meet more often and they search more thoroughly. Different ant species must use different algorithms because they've evolved to deal with different resources. And it could be really useful to know about this. And so we recently asked ants to solve the collective search problem in the extreme environment of microgravity in the International Space Station. The ants are working so hard to hang on to the wall or the floor or whatever you call it, that they're less likely to interact. And so the relationship between how crowded they are and how often they meet would be messed up. We're still analyzing the data. I don't have the results yet, but it would be interesting to know how other species solve this problem in different environments on Earth. So we're setting up a program to encourage kids around the world to try this experiment with different species. It's very simple. It can be done with cheap materials. And that way we could make a global map of ant collective search algorithms. And I think it's pretty likely that the invasive species, the ones that come into our buildings, are going to be really good at this, because they're in your kitchen because they're really good at finding food and water.
So, listener, before you spray the bejesus out of that parade of ants marching through your kitchen, you might want to give your five-year-old a little research project to help expand the antinet into areas that could give us some insights into even cancer treatment. As entomologist Daniel Mersch explained earlier in this KX935's The Share An Hour, tonight dedicated to the topic of ants, there's a very simple and inexpensive way to do this.
Why I need 5 years of university education for a task that a five-year-old could do?
She's joking, of course. That's just the prep. What a five-year-old is unlikely to be able to do is analyze the resulting data or even ask the right initial questions.
The first question we asked was whether ants segregated into groups, whether they had their set of friends, or did they talk to everybody? We extracted 9 million interactions and built networks once per day. Each network shows us how the circles of ants are connected to other ants. From that, we can see who interacted with who. And with a bit of math or magic, we could show that there are three groups of ants, and that ants mainly interact with other ants in their group. But who are these groups? Do they mean something? What do the ants in each group do? To find out, we counted for each ant how often it left the nest to forage for food, how often it went to the rubbish pile, and how often it went to the brood pile. As expected, some ants cared for the brood, others cleaned the nest, and again others left the nest to forage for food. But this we knew already. But to our surprise, ants that specialized in the same task were also in the same social group. That means that ants in each social group specialized in a given task, nursing, cleaning, or foraging, and that ants mainly interacted with other ants performing the same work. We discovered that ants are organized into working groups. Knowing that, we wondered what happened over time. Did ants always stay in their working groups? Or did they, like us, sometimes change jobs? We had 40 days of data, so we decided to split it in 4 10-day periods and look at period after period. Most ants stayed in their working groups, but 40% of the ants switched groups, and they did so in a predictable way. Most nurses switched jobs to become cleaners. Most cleaners switched jobs to become foragers. And foragers mainly remained foragers until death. This is the career path of an ant. The young and inexperienced ants care for the brood. Those that have gained some life experience and are in their best month of life get promoted to cleaners. And those that are old and weak leave the nest to forage for food and face the world of dangers. Knowing that colonies were organized with working groups and that every ant had its lifetime career path, we wondered what other organizational principles the ants might use. One aspect we had neglected so far was the spatial distribution. We knew that ants could not all be at the same location at the same time. That was physically impossible. But how did the ants organize themselves? How did they distribute themselves? Simply plotting the spatial position of all ants in each group showed us working groups were segregated like ghettos. Nurses spent most of their time on and near the brood. Foragers mainly gathered near the nest entrance. And cleaners occupied the remaining space. But what is even more surprising is an ant could easily move to all parts of the nest within a few seconds. But they hardly did so. Why? Did the ants indeed have some ants they really preferred? Or did they just talk to everybody whom they met on their wanderings through the nest? To find out, we used the trajectory of each ant to estimate the probability with which it would interact with members of its own working group and with members of other working groups. We then compared this estimated probability to the one we observed in the data. The result is disappointing, but enlightening at the same time. Ants have no friends, no confidant, and every ant seems to be just one of many. But it also means that ants don't discriminate other ants based on their job, size, age. An ant interacts with every other ant in the nest. It is sufficient that their paths cross. An ant society is highly egalitarian. There is no discrimination. There's also no friendship. We probably do not want to copy this lifestyle. None of the individual has a plan. But still together, they can build societies that compete with ours. We might find inspiration for computers or robots that help us solve problems in ant-like fashion. Migros Supermarket uses ant-inspired software to decide each day the order and route with which their trucks will deliver goods to the network of retail stores. Using the ant wisdom, they could shorten route length by up to 20%, thereby reducing CO2 emissions and cutting costs. Who would have predicted that we would gain such valuable and economic help from studying ants?
Who indeed? Migros Supermarkets, by the way, are in Switzerland, where Dr. Daniel Mersch, from whose TED Talk you just heard here on KX935's The Sharer Now, is from. They are an amazing species, ants, and depending on whom you talk to, there are between 12 and 14,000 known species of ants, and they are all over the world. Ants exist in every country, in every single continent, except, ironically enough, Antarctica. And studying how they respond to their different environments, whether wet or dry or warm or cold, is helping scientists and ecologists like Deborah Gordon, ecologist at Stanford University, understand, amongst other things, how different type of cancers behave in different parts of the world of the body.
So the most familiar resource for ants is a picnic. This is a clustered resource. When there's one piece of fruit, there's likely to be another piece of fruit nearby. And the ants that specialize on clustered resources use interactions for recruitment. So when one ant meets another, or when it meets a chemical deposited on the ground by another, then it changes direction to follow in the direction of the interaction. And that's how you get the trail of ants sharing your picnic. And this is a place where I think we might be able to learn something from ants about cancer. I mean, first, it's obvious that we could do a lot to prevent cancer by not allowing people to spread around or sell the toxins that promote the evolution of cancer in our bodies. But I don't think the ants can help us much with this because ants never poison their own colonies. But we might be able to learn something from ants about treating cancer. There are many different kinds of cancer. Each one originates in a particular part of the body. Then some kinds of cancer will spread or metastasize to particular other tissues where they must be getting resources that they need. So if you think from the perspective of early metastatic cancer cells as they're out searching around for the resources that they need, if those resources are clustered, they're likely to use interactions for recruitment. And if we can figure out how cancer cells are recruiting, then maybe we could set traps to catch them before they become established. Using only simple interactions, ant colonies have been performing amazing feats for more than 130 million years. And we could learn from this about other systems that operate without central control.
That was ecologist Deborah Gordon. I'm Sharon James. This is The Sharon Hour on Laguna's one and only listener-supported, member-supported FM radio station, KX935. And my topic tonight is ants. The thing that distinguishes ants from other kinds of communities is that they don't have leaders or employers, and yet they all seem to know their job. There is a queen, up to several millions of a typical ant colony of brothers and sisters, her offspring, but depending on the species, there can actually be more than one queen. In fact, many reproductive queens can be found in a colony. Queen ants are some of the longest living insects around. They can survive in the wild for up to 30 years. Compare that to a fly. Even the best of flies, I think, only live for a few days. Which is why you don't feel so terrible about swatting them to death. Or maybe you should feel more terrible since they have such limited lives anyway. When an ant dies, the workers take the corpse to a midden. An ant midden is the ant's trash site, where they also toss their food remains and other trash. The ants that are most likely to get sick and die are the ones that have to leave the nest to go forage for food. But even then, they're thinking of the community because those ants generally keep to themselves and avoid interacting with the queen and the babies so that they don't pass on infections to their more vulnerable compatriots. They live in long, kind of high rises, only their low rises going down into the ground, in a variety of chambers, and the shafts break off at different depths. Ant babies are kept in the deepest part of the nest, so they're safest from anything going on near the surface. And the youngsters are nearby, their job also being to feed and clean, but also to transport the babies and even the eggs. The oldest ants live and work near the surface, where they help defend the nest from predators or even other invasive ant colonies. They're also the foragers. They go off to find food, and those tasks are actually relegated to the females. Of course, they're the hardest and most time-consuming. Middle-aged workers are usually in the middle of the nest, where their jobs involve cleaning it and digging new tunnels and carrying the food. Sometimes their nests are inside in tree cavities or in logs that are rotting. Sometimes they're just in dirt outside, and almost always, whether slightly outside or inside, invisible to us humans. Every nest is excavated without a blueprint, without a plan, in the dark, and sometimes the ants don't even bother to construct their nests themselves. Sometimes they'll nest in burrows excavated by other animals, like rats and other rodents. So whether or not they invariably evict them is something scientists don't yet know. Some harvester ants stockpile their food in special chambers called granaries, so they can get at it in the event of bad weather or the threat of predators. They store their seeds in these special chambers. Then there are other chambers that act as their town dumps or laboratories. Like humans, most ants don't like to come into contact with their poop, although some species do actually use their droppings as manure for their gardens. But only those ants designated as, quote, sanitation workers are allowed to handle them. And then there are the ant varieties that grow their own food by forming fungus on decaying plant matter. And again, they like to do their farming in particular chambers. These are usually taller egg-shaped chambers because the fungus grow in vertical strands, eventually forming curtains. So then, with all these chambers of varying depths, ants can take advantage of changes in temperature and humidity. If the deeper parts of the nest become too cold, the worker ants might temporarily relocate the baby ants from the bottom of the nest to the shallower, warmer areas at the top. A variety of species, including the fire ant, move their brood around on a cycle as weather and other conditions shift.
Someday we may be adding a wing or two, a thing or two. We will make changes. What we have always been called, the folks who live on the hill.
Ants. The topic of my KX935's The Sharon Hour tonight? Yes, they're the folks who live on the hill, but not in cozy couples, in huge community masses. Scientists call ants superorganisms because they have a hard time surviving in small numbers, let alone by themselves. The most common variety are the army ants, the ones you see appearing from seemingly nowhere, and they don't build permanent nests. Instead, they construct a nest by designating a portion of their group to interlock their bodies around the queen and the larvae while the others go off to search for more food. Talking about interlocking bodies, I have to say I'm not quite sure whether the queens have all the sex, but they certainly have the important sex. It's all about procreating the species, and sometimes there'll be interspecies sex, and the queens will essentially steal sperm from male ants of other species, maybe unwittingly for the male. But there's not much he can do about it because once they've hooked up, as it were, he actually can't escape. Their sex organs are conjoined, so even if he tries to let go, they're still locked together. Though he can actually slow down the rate at which he's giving sperm to the queen to save some for a more suitable queen from his own species. On the other hand, the queens can control that to some degree by simply hanging on to their male partner for longer than he wants until they get what they think is their fair share of his sperm. Certain interspecial mating can result in sterile ants, but that's quite a good thing for the queen and the colony because she also needs to produce these sterile workers as builders for the colony. Then she can sit in her chamber and mate with males of her own species to produce more fertile offspring.
An ant colony consists of sterile female workers. Those are the ants you see walking around. And then one or more reproductive females who just lay the eggs. They don't give any instructions, even though they're called queens. They don't tell anybody what to do. So in an ant colony, there's no one in charge. And all systems like this without central control are regulated using very simple interactions. Ants interact using smell. They smell with their antennae, and they interact with their antennae. So when one ant touches another with its antennae, It can tell, for example, if the other ant is a nest mate and what task that other ant has been doing. So when one ant meets another, it doesn't matter which ant it meets, and they're actually not transmitting any kind of complicated signal or message. All that matters to the ant is the rate at which it meets other ants. All of these interactions taken together produce a network, and it's this constantly shifting network that produces the behavior of the colony, like whether all the ants are hiding inside the nest or how many are going out to forage. A brain actually works in the same way, but what's great about ants is that you can see the whole network as it happens.
Amazing ants. They're the topic of my KX925's The Sharon Hour tonight. They're quite admirable in many ways, most particularly in the way that they cooperate with each other in the nest, donating their particular skills to each other and filling in for each other when necessary. But of course, out in the world, they're not always quite as accommodating. They can attack. They need to for their prey. They can snap and bite. Trapjaw ants have mandibles that can open a full 180 degrees and snap shut at speeds of up to 143 miles an hour. And then there's the bullet ant that lives in Central and South American rainforests, and their sting is said to be one of the most painful of any insect, and the pain can last for an entire 24 hours. The pain's been compared to being shot, which is why they're called bullet ants. And then there's the crazy ants. Yes, there is a breed called crazy ants. They have another name, raspberry ants, and I'll get into the reason for that later. I will say, though, that it has nothing to do with fruit. This story of them comes from an article in the New York Times by Joe Mualem that tells of one Mike the Hogginator. He was called Mike the Hogginator because his thing is clearing feral hogs off his land. Feral hogs apparently cost us $1.5 billion every year in the damage they do. The Department of Agriculture calls these hogs a pandemic. But this is just to give you an idea of how Mike became not just the Hogginator, but also very anti-ants, even trying to do with them what he did with the hogs, which was take a gun and shoot them. So the story goes that the first time Mike noticed these ants, they were in a pile outside his cardiologist's office. They formed a fibrous heap on either side of the building's double doors. They were dead, but there were also legions of living ants shuffling over the dead ones, and they were moving chaotically and very fast. Now, the reason Mike was at his cardiologist's was because he suffered from an inoperable tumour on his aorta. He was only 36 when it was discovered, and his doctor told him to live every day as if it were his last. So he'd been doing that by bringing joy to others. He'd started a program called Therapy Through the Outdoors, and he'd been taking kids with terminal diseases and veterans with PTSD or other injuries on adventures in the woods just across from his house. Needless to say, those adventures included shooting as many feral hogs as he could. Anyway, not long after Mike had seen this mix of dead and crazy frenetic ants at his cardiologist's office, he saw them at his own house. His air conditioning had stopped working, and he noticed a musty smell coming from the vents in his living room floor. He found it was these ants at work. So he got out his shop vac to clear them out. That first time, he sucked out 5 gallons worth of ants. But it wasn't long before he and his wife woke up to find more frantic, huge networks of these ants zipping around the kitchen floor. They were going in all directions, and then his 50-inch TV started flickering. And he took off the back panel and, yeah, guess what he found inside? Ants. Tons of them. He dumped his television. But dead ants began pooling around the base of his house in heaps so high they looked like discarded coffee grounds. After Mike had laid out poison, there were even more heaps on heaps of these dead ants. But new ants kept coming, using those dead ants as a bridge over the top of the poison, a bridge into the inside of Mike's house. He says people stopped wanting to visit his house anymore. And if they did come, they left really quickly before the ants could stow away in their cars and accompany them home. He even had to cancel his program of therapy through the outdoors. He said at one point when he and his wife were sitting outside, there were so many ants and they were crawling over his bare feet that he ran inside to get his assault rifle, till his wife said, "Stop, you're just being ridiculous." He tried leaving different foods on his kitchen floor overnight, hoping he could bait the ants so he could kill them, like he'd done with the feral hogs. He said he tried donuts, crushed up Cheerios, straight old breadcrumbs. He said anything a normal ant would be attracted to, but they didn't touch any of it, so he couldn't fathom what the ants wanted, why they'd come. He said it made it more frightening because it made no sense. They run around the floor like they're on crack, and then they die. He said they're freaking crazy, man. And that's their name. This particular breed of ants are actually called crazy ants, although they also go by the name tawny crazy ants, or, as I mentioned before, raspberry ants, named not after the fruit or flavor or color, but after the man Tom Raspberry, who first discovered them and strangely named them after himself. By the way, ants, in case you hadn't realized it yet, are the topic of my Share An Hour tonight. That's with me, Sharon James, on Laguna's KX93.5. The breed of crazy ants, entomologists tell us, unlike other ants, seem to be drawn to electronic devices, car stereos, circuit boxes, any kind of machinery. So many will stream inside a device that their mass can complete a circuit and short it. They've ruined laptops that way and temporarily shut down chemical plants, according to one exterminator. They're probably climbing into these places to investigate possible nesting sites. But one research entomologist at the Department of Agriculture told the writer of this New York Times article, Joe Mu'allam, that the bugs could actually be attracted to the electricity itself. They do bite. It's not particularly painful. It's more that they freak people out because they'll race up and down their feet and around their bodies in every possible direction. They're called crazy ants because, unlike those very efficient lines of the more regular type of ants that we know, their disordered orbits make them seem psychotic. In Texas, where they're rampant, they've driven people into selling their houses or to the verge of divorce. One exterminator said, usually the husband can manage, but the wife's going batty. They decimate native insects, overtaking beehives and destroying their colonies. They've been known to smother bird chicks struggling to hatch. In South America, where scientists believe they originated, they've been known to obstruct the nasal cavities of chickens and thus asphyxiate them. Horrible. And there's no way to contain them known of to date. The worker ants of the tribe tend to die off when the temperature drops, but the queens survive, so a new, often larger crop of crazy ants comes pouring in the next spring. In Texas, they've become more prolific than the red fire ant, that's generally considered one of the worst invasive species in the world, and has cost the state of Texas more than $1 billion a year to try to eradicate. But they're not only in Texas. At this point, they've been spotted in Louisiana, Mississippi, Florida, and Georgia. Their advance into all these other states has caused a division of the Department of Agriculture to convene a crazy ant task force to see what they could do. It's made up of 18 people, including representatives from many state and federal agencies, plus, obviously, academic entomologists. Even though one task force participant said, "I don't think the federal government has a lot of money to spend on bugs," President Bush actually signed over $700 billion to the Troubled Asset Relief Program, TARP. But it's a catch-22. Nobody wants to release money to research or combat crazy ants until they knew exactly what kind of species they were dealing with. On the other hand, they need the funding, of course, to figure that out. Tom Raspberry, the guy who claims he discovered them and named them after himself, said when he appeared on CBS's The Early Show that the entire Gulf Coast is going to be inundated in a very short period of time. Raspberry said, "I wish I'd never heard of them, let alone discovered them," which he did while on a job at a chemical plant in the Houston suburb of Pasadena in 2002. He said, outside the office at that plant, he saw a couple of hundred ants traveling in erratic swirls. So he said, I just sprayed them with my can, no big deal. He said by the following summer, when he was called back to the exact same spot, quote, there were literally billions of them. And then they spread to surrounding areas, most likely transported in landscaping and soil or building materials, or by hitching rides in cars. Raspberry called the state and federal agencies and tried to communicate his alarm. He imagined that the government would automatically rush to stamp out such a threat before it escalated. He said, even though for me, from a monetary perspective, it was the best thing that these ants got totally out of hand, I tried to take the high road. But in the end, the government didn't really respond as quickly or determinedly as he'd expected. David Pimentel, who's an ecologist at Cornell, and his colleagues have estimated that invasive species cost the nation $120 billion. Not just the ants, there are brown marmorated stink bugs. They destroy apple crops. There are armadas of cocky frogs. Their screeching goes on all night and gets so loud that they've lowered property values in Hawaii. There are hundreds of thousands of giant African land snails, too, skulking around Florida. They eat through the stucco walls of houses, and they puncture car tires with their shells. And these snails are the size of rats.
The whirligig beetles are wary and fast, with an organ to detect the ripples. The arachnid moths lay their eggs inside other insects along the borders of fields or roads in clusters of white cocoons. The ribbed pine borer is a longhorn beetle. Their antennas are half the length of their body. They feed on dead red pine. Robber flies with their immobile heads inject a paralyzing fluid into their prey that they snatch from life in midair. The snow flea's mode of locomotion, strange and odd, with a spiny tail mechanism with hooks and a protracted tube from the abdomen to enable moisture absorption. The female praying mantis devours the male while they are mating. The male sometimes continues copulating even after the female has bitten off his head and part of his upper torso. Every night, wasps bite into the stem of a plant, lock their mandibles into position, stretch out at right angles to the stem, and with legs dangling, they fall asleep. If one places a minute amount of liquor on a scorpion, it will instantly go mad and sting itself to death. The bombardier beetle, when disturbed, defends itself by emitting a series of explosions, sometimes setting off four or five reports in succession. The noises sound like miniature popgun blasts and are accompanied by a cloud of reddish-colored, vile-smelling fluid. It is commonly known that ants keep slaves. Certain species, the so-called sanguinary ants in particular, will raid the nests of other ant tribes and kill the queen, and then kidnap many of the workers. The workers are brought back to the captor's hive, where they are coerced into performing menial tasks. And as we discussed last semester, the army ants will leave nothing but your bones. Perhaps you've encountered some of these insects in your communities, displaying both their predatory military and defense characteristics, while embedded within the walls of flesh and passing for what is most commonly recognized as human.
The inimitable Tom Waits on bugs. I'm Sharon James, and I'm doing my own bug show tonight, specifically on ants, on this KX935's The Sharon Hour. And I'm talking about a particularly invasive and erratic species called crazy ants. The deputy director of this National Invasive Species Council has said, by the time a species is big and bad enough to get people's attention, a local opportunity to fight it, when it's small enough to be halted, has often been lost. He says, these things can fall through the cracks, and raspberry ants seem to pour through those cracks, not just in wildland, but in suburban neighborhoods. And the Department of Agriculture hasn't historically considered ants a pest of agricultural significance. Tom Raspberry, the discoverer of these ants, he called the raspberry ants, took samples of these crazy ants and sent them to a lab in Texas to be identified. But it was a complicated process, and the consensus was that these were most like another invasive ant called Nylandaria pubens, which had been invading Florida neighborhoods for more than half a century. But in that time, they hadn't caused much trouble, so Tom Raspberry was convinced it couldn't possibly be the same ant. His crazy ant was ripping through Texas like a violent dust storm. So why would the same bug suddenly behave so differently and erratically? Raspberry had never had much interest or aptitude for science, nor did he find bugs that fascinating. Plus, he hates reading, but he willed his way through the entomological research looking for answers. His daughter, with the wonderful name of Mandy Raspberry Ganusho, said it became an obsession. He would come over once a week to see his grandkids and end up talking about crazy ants. And so long as the government was convinced that they were these Floridian pubens ants and not something new, they weren't that bothered about taking action, even as the situation in Texas grew more and more catastrophic. Though they have now financed a limited amount of research. Plus, the EPA has tweaked its regulations to allow the use of a high-powered pesticide against this ant. Meanwhile, the ants continue to invade. They caused $1,600 of electrical damage to one woman's car. They infiltrated the glass break detector of one house's alarm system, causing the alarm to blare. They did things like shut off the water at one guy's well. They crawled out of electrical outlets and microwave ovens and up people's clothes, trickling over feet and ankles and legs and in between toes. The writer of this New York Times article, Joe Mullum, says, "Soon they were spiraling up the tongues of my sneakers onto my sock. I tried to shake them off, but nothing I did disturbed them. Before long, I was sweeping them off my calves. There was nowhere to go. They were everywhere." He said, "I couldn't concentrate on anything anyone was saying. I got in my car and left." Tom Raspberry's fear is that they're going to usurp nearly every other insect species until it's just crazy ants everywhere. Raspberry said he did get a call from a woman a while back who said, "I know how to fix the ant issue." When she called, it was almost midnight, but he still listened to what she had to say. Her plan was to import anteaters. Raspberry said, "So, how many do you think we need to import? 1 million? 2 million? And how would we conduct the operation? Would we lead the anteaters around on leashes?" The woman thought for a moment and said, "If that's what it takes." So, listener, what do we feel about ants after listening to all this? Are they good or bad? Ultimately, like most living beings, both. Not so good for us when they invade our homes, but good for each other and to each other, right? I'd always sort of admired them and set them up as an example of an ideal society because they're completely selfless. They really live to serve each other. On the other hand, they're friendless. They do it without love. They do it by rote. So they're kind of automatons, really. They're robotic in their behavior. They can only have sex with their mother or grandmother. And that's simply to reproduce. And all the males are fighting for the same few women. And all those women do is sit around and lay eggs. They're called queens, but they have no power. So not such a perfect society, but one that has a lot to teach us, even by virtue of having survived this earth for millions of years, way, way, way longer than we humans. So they're doing something right. And as the various entomologists you heard from tonight on this The Sharing Hour, they have stuff to teach us because they are basically a collective mass of neurons acting not autonomously but collectively toward a greater goal. And if it means survival for 130 million years, there are definitely things that we can learn from the way they operate if we're concerned with our own survival. That's about it for my Sharing Hour tonight. But I'm going to leave you with a teaser for a future show based on some of what we've learned here tonight about ants. Listen to what Speaker Jane Addams has to say.
It's no secret that ants are among the most sophisticated species on the planet, and hands down the most successful in evolutionary terms. But not individually. Individually, ants are really unsophisticated. Even 100 ants are unsophisticated. If you put 100 ants on a flat surface, they'll pretty much just walk around in circles until they die of exhaustion. But if you put 500,000 ants together, they'll form themselves into a superorganism with a collective intelligence that far exceeds the intelligence of any individual ant. And so even though each individual ant is basically blind and only very minimally intelligent, together they're able to form an efficient path from their nest to your picnic blanket in a matter of minutes. When you think about it, it should actually be kind of amazing that they can do this. After all, nobody told them that you were there or that you have food. Now, this presents a major question. How could evolution have produced agents with such a stark contrast between their individual simplicity and their collective complexity? Able to solve problems like finding food or building a nest, problems that no single one of them could solve on their own, and that they solve together without any one of them having any idea that they're doing so.
Food for thought, eh? And something to be explored on a future Sharing Hour coming up. Meantime, if you want to hear this one again, you can do so on iTunes or go to our dedicated website, kx935.com. In my case, it's kx935.com/shows/the-sharing-hour. That's sharing without the G, hour with the H. But you can find all our shows on our website. If you live in Laguna Beach, do also listen live. Even if you have Alert OC or Nixie on your phone, we do have our own emergency alerts about what's going on. And very often our airwaves work where cell phone connection might be poor. Anyway, we've come to the end of the Sharing Hour tonight here on KX935. This is Sharon James, wishing you a great and fun week ahead.